Hello? Hello? Hello?
I live in an early 17th century manor house, and we're standing in the bedroom at the moment where the extraordinary sounds occur. There are two big bangs on the floor, and then lesser footsteps towards the window, as if someone were taking off his boots or something. My dog is very sensitive to this. And keeps
well, it was a glorious summer evening, and I was writing letters. I was alone in the house, apart from my small boy, and he was fast asleep in the next room. Well, quite suddenly, I heard a descending scale on the piano in the room downstairs, and it was followed almost immediately by the dog howling. Well, when I got into the room, it hit me. The atmosphere, it was very, very cold. It was rather like being in a damp cave.
I was so heavily asleep, I was almost in a torpor. And I was roused up suddenly by the most terrific sneeze right in my ear. Well, I turned on my heart thumping, I turned on the light, but there was nothing there. But what I do want to know is, can you catch a cold from a ghost?
You know the feeling. You're alone in the house and you hear a knock, a creak, a clink, even the hint of a voice or a footstep, perhaps the odd scraping noise. But you put it down to the wind or a mouse or a bird. Well, what if it's more than that, much more than that, a thing that goes bump in the night? Over the next witching hour, I'll be analysing some very weird recordings of such noises and of voices.
Dear Mr. Edison, I am profoundly indebted to you, not for the entertainment only, but for the instruction and the marvel of one of the most remarkable evenings it has been my privilege to enjoy. Though I lament to say that the voice I transmit to you...
The eerie voice of Gladstone recording a message to Thomas Edison. It's easy to see why the Victorians thought there was something ghostly about sound recordings. As Professor Stephen Connor points out, when Edison invented the phonograph, he took it for granted that we'd soon be recording and telephoning the dead.
Towards the end of his life, Edison devoted a lot of time and energy trying to open up communications. It was suggested that in the other world or in the afterlife, it was necessary to have a body of, as it were, spiritual technicians who would be able to build the links.
There have been books recently about the notion of telephone calls from the dead. I think there is one called Telephone Calls from the Dead.
I mean, I think that's partly because the telephone was invented at almost the same moment as the phonograph. Bell invented the telephone that separated voices from persons in space at the same moment as Edison invented an apparatus that would separate voices from persons in time. Technologies that seem to split the body up.
Ever since then, paranormal investigators have been striving to record authentic voices from the other side. But the problem is, what exactly does a ghost sound like? In the theatre, the ghost of Hamlet's father used to sound rather portentous.
Whither wilt thou lead me? Speak! I'll go no further.
Mark me.
I will.
My hour is almost come, when I to sulphurous and tormenting flames must render up myself.
Alas, poor ghost.
Pity me not, but lend thy serious hearing to what I shall unfold.
Speak.
Now stage spooks have lost their reverb and their vibrato, and even lost their voices. When Jonathan Pryce played Hamlet in 1980, he writhed on the floor, clutching his stomach, and produced the ghost voice himself. In fact, paranormal investigators claim that ghosts can possess our vocal cords or even vocalise via other parts of our bodies, like the diaphragm. But what if you've been asked to produce a spectral sound rather than an actual voice? The BBC Radiophonic Workshop conjured up hundreds of ghostly effects before it died, and composer Elizabeth Parker still finds herself commissioned regularly to imagine the sound of a supernatural atmosphere.
You start off with a synthesizer sound and you then add reverberation and you move it around the spectrum, you filter it, you pan it, and you get this sort of... But the sound that I tend to associate, if I'm doing a ghostly sound, basically a ghost is air, isn't it? It's a formation in air, and it's probably electricity in some form. So quite often I tend to take a sound that is more sort of, it's like pylons singing in the wind. People know there's something there. They don't know what it is, but you can just hear.
So it's, in a way, it's a kind of metaphorical sound. It's not how a ghost does sound.
Absolutely.
Or how a ghost should sound, but just how
suggestion.
A ghost feels.
Exactly. It's suggestion in your mind. I mean, especially on radio, you can't see anything anyway. So it's all about suggestion, and you've got this psychological, it's psychological sound. I mean, it's not saying there's actually a ghost there, but it's just saying there's something in the air.
What sound would convince you that it was a ghost, that it was surreal? Or would it be a question of gut feeling?
Oh, gut feeling. Gut feeling, I think. I would certainly recognise if something was synthesised, I think. I don't know, I have yet to hear anything.
This is Linda McGuire presenting Scope. The word itself is German. Its first part means noise, racket, hubbub. Its second part signifies ghost. The poltergeist has a long literary history. One is mentioned in Gossip from the Jade Hall, a Chinese work of 1,000 years ago. Probably the first one to intrigue a scientist was the demon drummer of Tedworth, which was investigated in 1662 by a fellow of the Royal Society, the Reverend Joseph Glanville, and was anthologized in the 20th century as the subject of a poem by Dame Edith Sitwell. Books on psychic phenomena and research are filled with equally alarming, if less romantic, reports on mischievous spirits.
One poltergeist was captured over and over again on tape. In 1977, a council house in Enfield, North London, was seemingly haunted by one of these noisy entities for 14 months. Beds were lifted in the air, furniture was rattled, pound notes caught fire, marbles were flung around violently, and one of the four children in the house, Janet, who was 11, started switching into a deep, guttural voice. Psychic investigator Maurice Gross had been trying to capture the voice of a ghost for several years when he heard about the Enfield case. Together with Guy Playfair, he spent 8 months producing over 180 hours worth of tapes. One or two excerpts were included in news reports at the time, and Maurice, now 79, is still convinced by his unnerving recordings. He brought some in, which have never been broadcast before. Maurice Gross, when you walked in here, the tape machine started of its own accord. The reel went round for a second and then stopped. What was that all about? What was happening?
I do affect electrical apparatus for some peculiar reason. I mean, I was nowhere near it. I was a good 6 feet away, I believe.
You've brought a tape with you with some...
Yes.
I ought to say alleged.
Some alleged ghost experience. You can say alleged if you like, but I can assure you it's all absolutely true. You're going to hear here the manifestation of a voice during the Enfield poltergeist case.
Let me hear you say my name again. Come on, let me hear you say my name. That's not my name.
Now, I think I ought to explain to you a little about the voice. We were in the downstairs in the living room talking when suddenly a dog barked in the room. Well, that wouldn't have been anything unusual if there'd been a dog there, but there wasn't. And then there was some sophisticated whistling, and this barking sort of continued, and I looked at the children very carefully, and I couldn't see them doing anything. I looked at their, see if they were trying to imitate a bark. They weren't doing anything. And I thought, well, this is very strange. And eventually we decided that if the barking took place that evening, or perhaps later, or wherever, next day, we would challenge it to talk. Because I thought, if it could bark and it could whistle, it could talk. And you just heard the first thing it said, which was my name.
It was a very odd quality to the bark. Mm. Very staccato.
Yes, well, the whole thing is staccato. Now, that's a very interesting thing, you see, about this voice phenomena. I'm glad you said the word staccato, because neither Guy Playfair or myself did we have any idea what a poltergeist voice should sound like. It was only after a bit of research later on we found that there was a case in the 19th century that had been written about, and it describes a voice, a poltergeist voice, in a public house, in an inn. And it describes the voice as being that of an old man speaking in a staccato manner. So we do a test where we told the girl to hold water in her mouth, and we then taped her mouth over. And lo and behold, it spoke. And that is literally an impossibility. I don't think there's a magician in the world that could do that. He eventually turned out to be a man, and he had lived in that house 15 years before, and he had died in that house. And he described the manner of his death, which we didn't know at the time how he had died. We eventually found out his description of his death was exactly how he had died. And many years later, it was, I think, let me see, how many years later? Ooh, about 15 years later, I had done a radio program, and I had a phone call afterwards, and a man at the other end said, "That's extraordinary listening to that, because that voice, that man, who was a poltergeist, was my father."
And was it the same voice as his father?
No, it was not the same voice as his father. He said, "That is not my father's voice, but it's very much my father's personality." That is quite extraordinary in its way, because it wasn't just one personality was coming through. Although he claimed to be the man who'd lived in the house 15 years before, there were other voices as well, other characters. There were eight, in fact. One of them used to swear like a trooper, so we always knew when that one was about.
So that voice we heard was speaking through the girl, was it?
Oh, yes. The next one is where he says, "I'm 72 years old and I come from Durance Park Graveyard, and I'm right near the church where Rena lives. All my friends come from there as well, and we all make a gang and go to the park, and we picked your house because I used to live here.
I'm 72 years old. I come from Durance Park Graveyard, and I have right near the church where Rena lives. And all my friends come from there as well, and we all make a gang and go to the park, and then we pick your house because I used to live here."
The next one, he's asked why he is in the bedroom.
"It's my bed.
We know you sleep on the bed. Why can't Janet fill you?"
"I'm invisible."
"You're invisible? Why are you invisible?"
"Because I'm a G-H-O-S-T.
I am a G-H-O-S-T. I'm a ghost."
"Did any friends go with you?"
"Did any friends go with you?"
"Yes, all of them. All the dogs, 68 dogs.
All the dogs, 68 dogs.
What have you got 68 dogs for?"
"What have you got 68 dogs for?"
"So that they can protect me from you killing me."
"Protect me from you killing me?"
"You could shoot me off."
"You could shoot me off.
How can we shoot you if we can't see you, Bill?"
"By praying to God."
"By praying to God."
"Sorry, I didn't hear that, Bill."
"By praying to God."
"By praying to God."
Unfortunately, it wasn't true.
What has happened to the house since? What's happened to the people since?
Well, the people since, the mother still lives there. The eldest daughter is married. She got recently married last year. Janet, the epicenter of the whole thing, she is, as far as I know, happily married with four children.
But Janet refuses to talk about it now. I took an extract for analysis to linguist Professor Tony Thorne, but played it first to our radiophonic composer, Elizabeth Parker.
"That is spooky. I got a shiver down my back on that one. I can't think of a machine that would recreate that. There's something about that one.
What is it about it?
I can't think of a machine that would actually get that kind of hollow quality. That's definitely not a harmonizer. It's not a phaser. I don't think it's frequency shifting. That is spooky. The change when he says you can pray to God or something, you know, that
by praying to God.
Yes, that jumpy sort of rhythm. I mean, a child, it's unusual. I don't think a child would have spoken like that. I do think there's something strange about that recording.
It's much more disturbing than the parlour room seance type conversation. But certain things strike one immediately. The phrasing that's used and the way the speaking in short bursts and the language that's used sounds childish. It's simplified and childish. It could be an elemental spirit. It could be a dead person speaking with difficulty, or it could be a very uneducated spirit. But it sounds to me as if it could be produced by a child. The other thing is that I have heard something similar to this before, and that is in cases of possession, which have been diagnosed as psychotic cases, in which people claim to be possessed by evil spirits, and then of either gender, they tend to speak in a very, very guttural voice coming from somewhere in the stomach. It happens in hypnagogic and hypnopompic states as people drift in and out of sleep consciousness and unconsciousness, that they sometimes speak in tongues or speak in a sort of transformed voice.
When the night wind howls in the chimney cowls and the bat in the moonlight flies and inky clouds like funeral shrouds sail over the midnight skies. When the footpads quail at the night bird's wail and the black dogs bay at the moon, then is the spectre's holiday, then is the ghost high noon. Uh-huh. Oh, then is the ghost high noon. Uh-huh. High noon.
It could well be that our next feature tonight could prove a little disturbing. You may be sceptical at the outset, but I would ask you to keep an open mind, as I tried to do when I read the story, which is described as the Amityville Horror. It's the story of a couple, the Lutzes, Kathy and George, who lived in a house near to New York, and they're both with me in the studio now. George... First of all,
The Amityville Horror of 1975 appeared not to need a human host. Its voice, or voices, seemed to appear out of thin air.
On occasion, we could hear crying, quite a deal of screaming, words formed to tell us to stop.
Mm-hmm. You actually heard the spoken
word? Yes, we
did,
and that was witnessed by the friend who had suggested to us to bless the house. Mm.
Well, you, George, heard music, didn't you?
At 3:30 in the morning, what sounded like a number of instruments being tuned up all at once would go off downstairs, and we thought it was some kind of electrical device that had gone off, like a clock radio or something. Mm-hmm. The problem was that the dog slept at the bottom of the staircase there, and he never woke up when that noise went off, and it went off on a regular basis along about the third and the fourth week we were there.
Now, your youngest child, Kathy, the little girl, was what sort of age at this time?
Five.
It's, I think, a commonly held belief that where there is any form of poltergeist activity, and yours was certainly much worse than that, children are always present. It was your daughter, wasn't it, who claimed to have seen and spoken with some creature. I mean, she described it as
That's
a pig.
Right. On one occasion, Missy came down and she said, Mommy, do angels talk? And I couldn't understand what brought that question about. On another occasion, I went upstairs and stood in front of her bedroom door, and I heard her talking. And when I opened the door, she had a small white rocking chair in the corner. Missy was talking, and the rocking chair was rocking, and you could hear another voice, but you couldn't see anything.
Missy claimed the voice was emanating from a pig. Later, the Lutzes discovered a boy had murdered his entire family while they slept in the house. The boy's defence lawyer claimed he'd been prompted by voices himself. The Lutzes moved, and no recordings were made at Amityville. Psychic researcher Maurice Gross says you can waste hours and hours of tape waiting for significant sounds and rarely capture a thing. This happened while he was recording a BBC video diary during an overnight vigil in a medieval manor house.
I settled in for a long night, waiting patiently for nothing to happen, as usual. But then... Here we are. Hey,
is this recorder?
Yeah. Turn the camera. Well, I certainly didn't, because I was just sitting here and I was almost dozing. It came with tremendous force.
It appeared that a teacup had spontaneously exploded or smashed in the dark in the middle of the room. It hadn't been in the room when they arrived and may have been a paranormally placed object known as an apport.
Something was very peculiar about the sound of the apport cup crashing compared to the sound of similar cups we had just tested. I took the tapes to the BBC sound experts for analysis.
On a first hearing, it does sound much like much more than a cup, because you'd expect the little tinkle-tinkle of the cup, and that has a very, very bass sound to it. It's like a big thump or an explosion or something. It's also very loud.
Does it sound like a cup exploding?
Quite possibly, yes, it does. There is something else there. There's a big thump, there's a very low bass sound, which you just wouldn't expect and which you don't get from this.
It's very interesting indeed. I think it may begin to prove our point, that it was a paranormal apport. Well, I'm sure it was, but still...
But it has to be said that most apparitions are silent as the grave. Listen to this classic evocation of a ghostly presence from Henry James's Turn of the Screw, where the governess has just taken up her job teaching Miles and Flora.
I had not gone to bed, but sat reading. Fielding's Amelia, I think it was, by the light of two candles in my room. The white curtain of Flora's little bed shrouded the perfection of childish rest close by me. Suddenly, my author's spell was shattered. I sensed there was something undefinably astir in the house. I looked hard at the door. I listened. A soft breath from the open window gently moved the half-drawn blind. Then, with deliberation, I put down my book, took up a candle, and went out of the room, locking the door behind me. Holding my candle high, I went along the landing till I came within sight of the tall window that presided over the great turn of the staircase. My candle went out. And there, in the early morning light from the window, I saw him, Peter Quint. He was halfway up the staircase and right opposite me. He stopped and fixed me with a stare, just as he had done from the tower and from the terrace. We faced each other in our common intensity. He knew me as I knew him. He was a living, detestable, dangerous presence. But I met him and measured him and was not afraid. And he knew I had no terror. We gazed in dead silence. It was as hideous and human as a real interview, and only unnatural in that we did not speak. If I had met a murderer at such an hour in such a place, at least we would have spoken. So long were we there that I began to doubt if I were in life. Then, still in silence, the figure turned and went down the staircase into the darkness and was gone. He had gone. Gone.
Unlike actors, the ghosts that haunt theatres tend to be voiceless. Most old theatres have a resident phantom, and the Theatre Royal Drury Lane is awash with silent spectres, with the man in grey topping the bill.
There was the other story, of course, where we had a cleaner, apparently, walk down from the back of the upper circle and saw somebody sitting in a seat. And she went down to ask him who he was, and it was this man with the tricorn hat, and he simply disappeared, like that, bang. And she passed out. There was another occasion when, quite recently, I had a lady spiritualist come to see me who had been to the theatre to see a show, but she said the auditorium was so full of ghosts at the time, she lost all interest in the show and was just concentrating on Ghost. And she wanted to walk around with me. And she actually did walk around. Where we are now, she came with me, and she said at the time that the man in grey was standing behind us the whole time, and he walked with us right the way around the building.
I think we'll move on a bit in case he's behind us.
Oh, if you feel very cold, that is a sure sign.
When they were rebuilding Drury Lane in the 19th century, they broke it down and found a sort of false wall had been put in, and there was a skeleton in the wall which apparently had been walled up, and a dagger was thrust into the ribs. So obviously someone had been murdered at some time. And
That's true, is it? Or yes. It sounds so theatrical, it seems untrue to me.
No, that's absolutely true.
Theatre historian Malcolm Jones, who's a walking encyclopedia of thespian spooks from Garrick to Pavlova.
The Haymarket Theatre is supposedly haunted by Jade Buxton, who was the manager of the Haymarket Theatre. Margaret Rutherford, the actress, said that she'd seen this ghost moving around.
I was playing at the Haymarket 2 years ago, and we had to sleep in the theatre. I saw somebody in my dress cupboard. I saw a leg, the leg of a man. And, of course, there is a famous ghost who haunts the Haymarket, a former manager. And I felt he'd come to see me. I was really very pleased, so I stroked his leg and I thanked him.
Strangely, Nell Gwynn has never been seen, they say. But Dan Leno, Edmund Kean, his son Charles Kean, Charles Macklin, an actor who himself murdered a fellow actor in a duel in the green room, stabbed him in the eye with a stick and killed him. The actor-manager William Terrace in the late 19th century was stabbed to death by an insane actor called Richard Prince. Two taps are traditionally heard on the dressing room door at the Adelphi that signify Terrace is around. Her Majesty's has Herbert Beerbohm Tree. The Garrick Theatre traditionally has David Garrick. They have strange knockings have been heard at that theatre, and Arthur Bouchier, who was the actor and manager at one point, was also seen. None of these ghosts appear to my research to actually speak.
There is one there.
There's a nice story of one of the security men, stage doorkeepers, late at night after the show had finished and the theatre was dark, hearing the Dying Swan by Saint-Saëns being played on a soul cello, you know, as it should be. But and he sort of went back. He thought no one was in the theatre. This, of course, was Pavlova's famous piece of music. And he went back into the theatre, very great trepidation, and found a cellist playing in the pit who just bought this new cello, said, I can't play it at home, but I really wanted to try it out tonight, so I just thought I'd stay behind after the show. During Death Trap in the 1980s, one of the most interesting sort of ghostly things in theatres was that a voice persisted in prompting the actors during the performance, and the actors saying to the stage manager, who is doing that? Where is that coming from? There was never any, answer to who it was.
And was it sticking to the script?
Yes, and apparently it was following them almost sort of just, it was speaking the script just before them. It's very irritating for an actor feeling you're being prompted when you know the script very well.
Of course, some ghosts choose to whisper to Claire.
Of course, some ghosts choose to whisper to Claire audience, mediums who claim to hear voices from the other side. Only the medium hears the voice, a bit like Harry Corbett and Sooty.
I have a gentleman here with you. He said to me, I shared your life.
Yes.
And I loved you so much.
Yes.
He said to me, you know, it was better for me to go first.
Yes.
Right. He said, will you tell her I couldn't have managed without her?
No.
He said, I wasn't the easiest, you know.
No, right now.
He said, in fact, I was very difficult.
Yes, that's true.
Did you nearly leave him?
Yes.
I'm trying to be careful.
Yes.
Because he said she nearly ran away twice.
Yes, that's true. Although I wouldn't have done, not really.
Well, you tried.
Yes.
Who's Tom? He's talking about.
Well,
now, I'll tell you, before you tell me, who did you know that played the mouth organ?
My It was my first husband. I got them both here then? Yes, you must have them. Yes.
A fine theatrical performance from medium Doris Collins. You're listening to Ghost in the Machine, Radio 4's archive hour featuring the voices of the dead, allegedly. In the early 19th century, mediums didn't just repeat supernatural whisperings. According to cultural historian Professor Stephen Connor, spirits used mediums as amplifiers, possessing their vocal cords.
Audiences were amazed to hear the voices of gruff sailors emanating from slight physical frames of female mediums and so forth. Towards the end of the century, a new phenomenon began to appear in spiritualist seances. The direct voice. The direct voice was a way of producing voices that did not go through the body of the medium. They were direct because they came directly from the seeming spirit or source.
So the medium would be in the room, but the voice would come from somewhere else.
The voice would come from somewhere else, sometimes through a trumpet. Direct voice mediums in the 19th century were often called trumpet mediums because they would use a trumpet that would sometimes be levitated mysteriously and moved around the room. One of the most celebrated direct voice mediums was a woman called Etta Reet. She operated in a little kind of center of spiritualist operations known as Julia's Bureau that had been set up by the journalist W.T. Stead. And one of her most impressive effects was to produce the voice of W.T. Stead himself after his death on the Titanic. In fact, he explains, among other things, why it is that the voice is so much more impressive, a kind of testimony to life after death, than appearance. He says that you just can't disbelieve the evidence of voice, that voice speaks to you of living presence in a way that images don't.
This century's most celebrated and most recorded direct voice medium was a man called Leslie Flint. See what you think of him conjuring up Oscar Wilde, followed by Lillian Bayliss.
I'm not quite sure if you can hear me.
Hear you quite well.
Very nicely. I've never been known to say nothing.
Please, may we have your name, Shandor?
If I couldn't say something of value, then I'd much rather say nothing. This is most extraordinary. And then again, being dead is an extraordinary business.
Of course I've met Shakespeare, and what a different person he turned out to be.
Oh,
very, very interesting character indeed, and a very charming person. And he doesn't speak in old English.
I've been to a seance with Leslie Flint, and he was a very, very good medium. I don't think it matters whether the voice is different or not, because even if it was the voice of, say, Oscar Wilde manifesting through him, it wouldn't necessarily be the same voice. Even if Oscar Wilde was manipulating his vocal cords, it wouldn't necessarily be the same voice. It may be like him.
So rather like a violinist playing a different violin.
Yeah. I think it's the evidence that is most important. What evidence does the medium produce?
I think the first thing that strikes me is the similarity in the tone and articulation, if not in every quality, of the two voices. This doesn't necessarily mean that they both originated from the same person, which would imply that they're phony. But there's a rather theatrical, rather artificial intonation and over-articulation in each one. Oscar Wilde may well have spoken like that, but the Lillian Bayliss, I think, is slightly less likely. The other thing, which I can't be entirely sure of, but from my knowledge of accents, I would place both those accents as post-Edwardian. It's not an exact science, but there are recordings of extant, of Victorians speaking, and that was a passable imitation. But they both sounded to me far more accents characteristic of the first half of the 20th century. It's been said many times, but I think this bears it out yet again, that what is said from the other side, the content of the messages, is always very banal. I mean, I met Shakespeare, says Lillian Bayliss, and he was a...
I'm still with you.
...nice man, a very charming man.
So you'd expect them all to be very portentous, would you? Or, I mean, it is a fact, isn't it, that people are fairly trivial and banal in their interests on Earth. So why... These people might say, why should they change?
It's just that I'm very naive, but if I try to imagine this encounter between the living and the dead, I can only see it. I think back to the Norse sagas. I think back to the shamanistic idea of encounters with the dead being something charged and resonant and extremely dramatic, in which the messages which are passed across with great difficulty across this life-death interface are things of enormous import. And I just cannot believe people would waste those seconds in golf club banalities. There have been accounts of meetings with spirits, vampires, returnees from the dead, revenants, this kind of thing. And there, again, one tends to get drama. One tends to get descriptions of screaming, raucous voices of spirits bellowing like bulls, screaming like children or banshees. Very, very, never does one hear of a sort of relaxed, quiet, suburban conversation.
Leslie Flint is a fascinating example of a mass media medium. He describes in his autobiography how his first control, I mean the first person who made contact with him from the other side, was none other than Rudolph Valentino. And the reason why it was Rudolph Valentino and why this was so important for Leslie Flint was that, of course, he was a silent film star. And Leslie Flint speaks of wanting desperately, as so many wanted, to hear what his voice was like.
The voices collect around Leslie Flint. You don't need to address your question to him to have him pass it on to the voice. You can speak directly to the voice, and one of these voices declared itself to be Rudolph Valentino. And it was intrigued to find that there was someone present, namely myself, who had written a book. As he says, I hear that you've written another book about me.
You have written another book, huh?
Yes,
I there are not too many already.
Are you talking to me?
Yes. I am talking to you.
Yes, I finished the book. It comes out in June.
I don't understand why it is that people are so interested after all this time. It puzzles me very much.
But does it please you?
Well, I don't know. You ask me if it pleases me. I am neither pleased.
Indeed. The cinema seems to have been an important part of Flint's evolution, or the evolution of his powers to produce voices separate from his body. He describes the disruptive effects, for example, of going into a cinema and, as it were, producing a psychic soundtrack and having to leave because all of these voices would start to bubble up out of him. And the fact that it is somehow first of all the cinema and then subsequently the dead who are producing these voices indicates that by the 20th century, media and mediumship have become profoundly entangled.
But most spirits are far from media friendly, impossible to capture on a tape machine because they refuse to speak. Ghost hunter Paul Lee has a doctorate in nuclear physics.
I don't know whether they occur in the environment or in the head, but if they are just flimsy clouds of electrons or whatever, that might explain why they don't make any noise. To vocalise, you really need vocal cords. There's a huge debate amongst ghost hunters as to what ghosts really are, whether they do have intelligence, whether they're recordings that play back under the right conditions. So there's a big debate there. Sometimes they make noises, sometimes they don't.
Recordings? Could you explain what you mean?
Well, there's a theory in ghost hunting. It's called the stone tape theory. It was named after a BBC drama from 1972 written by Nigel Neal. And a group of scientists found out that somehow the imprint of an apparition had occurred in the material surroundings of a room. And when the conditions were right, the ghost replayed itself.
So the room was acting as a sort of magnetic tape recorder, really?
That's right, yes. And it was only visible or audible to certain people who had the correct mechanisms in their brain.
There were some people in Wales who apparently tried to activate one of these kind of magnetic walls to get...
That's
ancient
right, yes.
Voices coming out of them, or noises, didn't they?
That's right, yes. I think it was a chemist and an electrical engineer.
Now, I know that a lot of people aren't going to believe this next item. You see, it's about a wall that talks and plays music and ticks like a clock and has footsteps. Not any old wall, of course, but a very old wall indeed, 800 years old. More specifically, it's the wall of a pub called the Prince of Wales in Kenfig Hill, mid Glamorgan. Two regulars of the pub, Alan Jenkins, a mineral crystallographer, and John Marks, an electrical engineer, fell to discussing, as one does sometimes in the pub, they tell me, what stories the wall could tell if it talked. And then they thought, perhaps if the components in the wall were similar to those found on a recording tape, then they argued it could indeed have been recording sounds for 800 years, and sounds which perhaps they might be able to reproduce. So they tried, and this is part of the recording they got. John Marks, you're one of the people who recorded those curious sounds. What do you make of them? What were they, do you think?
We just don't know. They could be in the walls, and my chemist friend brought out the theory of silica and ferric salts.
Well, the stuff used in magnetic tape?
Yes, that's what we reasoned, and my contribution was, well, let's jigger up those electrons a bit with some electricity.
And how did you do that? What did you do, in fact?
Well, I used a transformer of the order about 15,000, 18,000 volts.
We heard some sort of muffled words on one of your tapes. They weren't Welsh. They weren't English. What were they?
We don't know. We don't know. They reoccur. They reoccur in different days and different positions of the room. We just don't know. They're not loud enough to be understood. But we'll work on it.
The Stone Tape television drama also predicted that ghosts could literally enter machines, computers, producing mysterious printouts.
What the hell?
That's not computer language.
It's your code number. You fed it in.
I didn't.
You must have done.
There are words. There might be words. See... pray.
So, that's so there.
Pray. Prayer.
It's in the computer!
In fact, more and more people are now claiming to have ghosts in their machines, voices appearing not in real time and space, but within tape recordings, telephones and computers, not to mention radios and TVs. Electronic voice phenomena, or EVPs. Skeptics put them down to stray signals or low-frequency standing waves, which can affect our perceptions. But in 1959, the Swedish opera singer and film director Friedrich Jürgensen said he could hear his mother calling his name, superimposed on a birdsong recording. In the 70s, the Latvian Konstantin Raudiv recorded polyglot voices from white noise on a wireless. And in the 1980s, in the English village of Doddleston, a couple claimed an Elizabethan gentleman infiltrated their computer. Some EVPs allegedly even respond to questions. See what you think of these extracts. They're from a CD on a record label called Ash, which specialises in recordings of the dead. And they're broadcast here for the first time.
If you'd like to speak a bit closer into it, I don't know whether you think of anything to say.
Good afternoon, Lord.
That's what something sounds a bit deaf, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But you get used to that, you know, speaking into thin air. And you see, that's the background.
Yeah.
That's a little. We have to see what that is, you see.
Yeah. Is that on the aircraft?
Yes. That's not an aircraft pilot. They speak English. Yeah. All aircraft pilots speak English.
Now the experimenter calls the Russian poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, and a voice answers. Mayakovsky. The experimenter tells the poet how difficult it is to convince people of the reality of the voice phenomenon, and in reply comes a statement which is typical for Mayakovsky's personality. Konstantin, pluj. In Russian, Konstantin, spit on it.
I think that a lot of them are just due to people hearing things that they want to hear. Like most of ghosts, they're seeing things which aren't really there, like patterns in trees and patterns in the sky, for instance. Or it could be that the radio was mistuned to a channel between two stations and it accidentally picked up one of the stations and that's what they're hearing. Or it could be garbled taxi communications. It could be anything. Normally, the person who's proposing them will come to you and say, hey, here's a voice, give you the tape, you hear it, and they say, they said this, this, and this. And then you say, yes, of course, I hear it now. But if you hear it in isolation without being prompted, you'd think, it's just garble, it's just static, I can't make out anything at all.
On the 16th of July, 1976, this is Raymond and Ingrid. Thank you. Thank you. We'll have to decipher that. But we thank you for answering us.
Sir Larkin, where are you? Can you respond? Have you anything to say to your friends?
Nothing.
The Heartless?
Not sorry.
We are, in a sense, meditating upon the mechanizing of the voice. We are, in a sense, I think, attempting to put the ghost back in the machine when so much of our technologized life seems to be emptying the ghost out and rendering us as simply machines. But I think it may also be more complicated than that, because it's always been plain that the voice is, in part, a machine. There's a profound and really insoluble conundrum here. As you listen to this voice, I mean, as a radio listener, you're hearing a disembodied voice. I heard somebody on the way into the studio on the mobile phone saying to her interlocutor, I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Whenever you speak, you're breaking up. You're breaking yourself up and reassembling, in a sense, rewiring yourself. So I've turned myself into an utterly different kind of being. There's a virtual body, a kind of oral homunculus that I have become by speaking. So the body always tears you apart from yourself and rebuilds you in some other imaginary space. And that is why I think it is that the voice is so apt to be seen not only as the sign of what is most real and alive about you, but also as the thing that makes you ghostly.
EVPs were first noticed by wireless operators in the Second World War, and it's during the war that reports of haunted aeroplanes first emerged. The Lincoln bomber RF-398 currently resides in a hangar at Cosford Aerospace Museum in Shropshire. But at night, the interior of this now dead aeroplane is alive with metallic clicks and switching noises, as if a phantom crew is preparing for flight. Paranormal investigator Ivan Spensley left his recorder running inside RF-398, walked out of the empty hangar and locked the door behind him. He then asked a former RAF crew to operate the equipment as they would before a flight, and then to compare notes with the clicks he recorded.
You know, there's a sort of magnetism about this aircraft. The first time I came on it, of course, was with a team of ghost hunters. And at that time, we got some very, very strange sound recordings, which still haven't been explained to my satisfaction.
It has nothing to do with hangar noise. It has been said, of course, by one or two sceptical people that maybe the hangar settling down at night makes a noise. But there is definite force behind that noise. Hangar 547, which this hangar is an old wartime hangar. And fairly recently, I met an ex-RAF policeman who had been based at Cosford about 30 years ago. And according to him, even then, that particular hangar had a reputation. They heard voices in the hangar, things were moved about in the hangar, and people were even seen walking about in the hangar in flying gear.
Just see what you make of this. Someone is doing something mechanical.
It's definitely nothing to do with the wind, is it? Hangar doors or roof?
No, it's in the aircraft.
It's definitely in the aircraft.
Somebody must have operated a switch somewhere.
These are the attachments for the nav equipment.
Well, I think I've heard that sound before.
And I'm adjusting the seat.
You can imagine my surprise when I made the first tape recording in here and I locked the aircraft in the hangar and returned to find the tape recorder turned off, the lid opened, and the tape pulled from the reels and scattered around the machine like a huge pile of black spaghetti. That shook me.
Yes, it appears that some ghosts are very anxious not to be recorded.
It's very, very frustrating. You may get a sound, a noise, an explosion, and you hear it, nothing comes out on tape. And very often you get the noise and you're talking into the tape and you're giving your commentary, and when the tape is played back, there's no commentary. Sometimes we have tapes that are wiped completely clean. That's why you have to test your tapes before I go. Just in case. And very often you get the noise and you're talking into the tape.
Oh well, so far so good.
Ghosts I have met.
I heard them a terrific row in the dining room. It sounds as though the long windows in there had been smashed in by a troop of ruffians. I didn't know what had happened because there was tamping and shouting and storming about and falling of glass and china. Fearful noise. Then there was a shout from behind me in my left ear. What do you mean by coming to my house? How dare you come into my house?
Another happy ghost I've known was in an ancient Midland manor house, where I was present on the day that a Tudor doorway, stairs, and a secret room were discovered. It is the home of an old family who were Catholic recusants under the harsh reign of Elizabeth. The maid, bringing in the first course at dinner that evening, dropped the lot in fright and gasped out that there was an old man with a white beard out in the passage staring at her. We rushed out and saw, framed in the Tudor doorway, the dignified figure of an Elizabethan priest in his black cassock and small white beard. The figure smiled, turned slightly towards my host, raised a hand in blessing, and said quite distinctly, in what you might call a loud whisper, "Pax tibi filius, peace to you, my son." My host being speechless, I replied, "Et tibi pax, pater, and peace to you, father." Then I asked him, speaking very slowly and distinctly, "Why are you here? You have frighted the serving girl." He replied, "I am able to come to you because you have found my room. I was happy here. I was the family priest."
If there's any moral in this spectral trawl through the sepulchral BBC tape vaults, it's that the people on archive who've met ghosts seem to have got over it and are living happily ever after. I'm told radio signals can go on for centuries, so for all I know, my voice will haunt someone in the next millennium. Perhaps they'll have to exorcise me. Sleep well.
Of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, I command thee, by the true God, the living God, the holy God, that thou spirit of violence, that thou depart from this thy servant. O God, Son of God, unconquered might, who keepeth all those that are against thee, and by his death hath destroyed death and overcome the prince of death. Beat down Satan under our feet, cause this violent spirit to depart from this thy servant and go unto the place prepared for it, to the end of the world by far, and give place to Christ.
The veil between the two worlds is wearing thin. It is possible, given the right conditions, to communicate with those we call the dead. They don't think of themselves as dead, but as now fully alive. And I am grateful to the authorities of the BBC for allowing me to express my mature convictions unhindered in what may possibly prove my last talk to you. If it should happen that my work down here is done or nearly done, let me take an affectionate farewell. Goodbye.
Ghost in the Machine was produced by Robin Reed and Ian Peacock, who also presented it.